Tonight on Standing Room Only, Paying the Price.
Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
From May 31st to June 3rd, the Working Class Studies Association held their annual conference at Indiana University. Each day, there were several rounds of panels and speakers. On June 2nd, keynote speaker Sarah Goldrick Rabb detailed her research into why so many students are forced to drop out of college and leave with debt. Goldrick Rabb is a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University, and in 2016 published her book, Paying the Price.
I think one of the reasons that we've been getting things wrong in American politics and policymaking over the last, say, 50 years is that we don't actually get to know the people who those policies are aimed at serving very well before we craft those policies. I thought when I set out on this big research project back in 2008 to try to understand what was happening in college today, you know, I thought that we should actually start with the students. So first, I want to introduce you to a young woman named Chloe Johnson, all pseudonyms, all real people, however, and very much, frankly, still in the midst, many of them, as you'll hear, of trying to get those degrees. Chloe Johnson and I met at a technical college in a city in Wisconsin. Okay, all of the students I'm going to introduce you to are from Wisconsin. We're sitting in Indiana. I've been in Pennsylvania. I've been in Arizona and California. We're finding students like this all over the country. I don't really think it's unique to that place. Chloe Johnson grew up in a small town about 100 miles from that college, and it was centered around a paper mill. That was the main economy. And the year that she graduated from high school, that paper mill closed. To top it all off for Chloe, in that same year, her parents decided to get divorced. And she wasn't really sure what the next steps were in her life, especially with those new sorts of uncertainties. But as she told me, you know, she went to college because that's kind of what you do. Right? It's what's expected of you. And I think this is really important, she said, it just feels like you can't get a decent job without a college education. Now, what does decent mean? I wanted to kind of understand where her judgments were about what was good and what was not and what was appropriate for her. This is a working class kid. And the fact was, she'd been working for a long time. So she did actually have a sense of what were good working conditions, what were bad working conditions. And she knew that the kinds of job that she had had so far, working at places like PetSmart and McDonald's, were not treating her well. They were not treating her with respect. She didn't know when her next shift would be. She didn't know how many hours she would be getting in a given week or month, so she couldn't count on it. And of course, she didn't feel like her boss respected her. She thought she wanted to move on to a decent job in an area that she cared about. And what she cared about growing up in a semi-rural area were animals. And she especially cared about horses because she had had a horse since she was 10 years old. And so she thought what she would like to do is become a veterinary technical assistant. Well, why not a veterinarian? And she said that she didn't need to be that important, because veterinarians have to make life or death decisions about animals, something she did not feel she wanted to take on in her life. So she was aiming for a veterinary technical assistant degree, of which there were only two colleges with programs in the state of Wisconsin, and she went to enter it. It's a two-year program, okay? So I hope that this gives you a sense, right, of this young woman's set of ambitions. The fact that she was not focused on a bachelor's degree was important. The fact that she did feel an economic imperative, but that she was thinking beyond just the mere economics of the here and now. She was thinking about things like having respect in her life. She was thinking about things like having stability. And she had thought through some of these choices. This depiction of an undergraduate is not how undergraduates are typically depicted in this country right now. So Academically Adrift paints a very different portrait of folks who really don't know why they're there, folks who really don't want to be challenged, maybe the faculty who are complicit in not challenging them, etc. That's not really who I met. who I have met over a career now of studying the nation's undergraduates. I'm sure there are some out there like that, but more than 50% of today's undergraduates are receiving Pell Grants and are much more similar to people like Chloe Johnson. We interviewed 50 students intensively over 6 years for this study, and these 50 represented 3,000 students, who I'll tell you about in a little bit. A couple of months after we first met Chloe, we met another guy named Ian Williams. Ian grew up in a very different place than Chloe did. It was not a rural town, it was a major urban city in Wisconsin. You could might be able to think of it. It's a city of intense segregation and concentrated poverty. He really wasn't quite sure about what he wanted to do, but that he sort of knew that, you know, it was important to go. But he frankly wasn't even all that sure he was gonna get out of high school. And it makes sense, because he came up in a public school system that is widely considered among the worst in the nation. He was the only one in his family who'd actually made it out of that system. He was going to college to become one of the first in his family to go. And what he was gonna do with the money was to pay his mom's bills. Okay, so he figured that even if he just got out of high school and had a job and paid bills, that he would be paying his mom's bills. And he very quickly began to teach us that when he thought about the economic returns to college, he wasn't just thinking about the money he was going to take and stick in his pocket. He was thinking about covering his mom's bills. Because as he explained to us time and again, it was his mom who made it possible for him to get to college in the first place. Alicia went to the same school as Ian. Alicia's motivation for going to college, she watched her mom go through hell. Okay, in order to make ends meet, her mom had to rely and stay with a guy who just didn't treat her very well. She made it very clear to us the reason that she was in college was to prevent that from happening to her. Okay? And finally, there was Nima. Nima, like so many of today's students, was not born in the United States. Okay, Nima came to this country, she said, through one of the greatest events and strokes of luck in her life, which was when her family won the immigration lottery in Nepal. Okay, we were studying at the time a financial aid program that was awarding students some extra money for college, and Nima said that when she won that award, it was the second best thing that had ever happened in her life. And like Ian, what Nima was after by going to college were the resources to not primarily pay for herself, but to pay for her family and to not only pay for the mother and father and grandmother and three siblings who lived in a two-bedroom apartment with her throughout college, but also to send money back home to Nepal. Okay. So these are the sorts of folks who we see today among our nation's Pell recipients, who again are the nation's majority of college students. We have accomplished something over the last 50 years that we shouldn't diminish. And that is that folks like the ones I just showed you, they go to college today. Okay, in the past, as we all know, if you grew up without a parent who'd been to college or much in the way of economic resources, the very idea that you'd be enrolling in college in the future, that that would be a reality for you, that was fairly uncommon. But I think where the real crisis is, if we take those folks who actually do enter college and we follow them out over 6 years of time, which is a reasonable window. It is, we could go further out, the numbers still wouldn't climb all that much. We see that 60% of those students will not end up with a credential of any sort. I'm not saying they don't all get bachelor's degrees, okay? I think bachelor's degrees are important, but let's be honest, there are real returns to certificates and associate degrees, and some of those degrees actually bring you greater returns than the bachelor's degree. Moreover, if we believe the college experience itself brings dividends, even a couple of years of college will start to do that. Folks like Charles Mansky, an economist at Northwestern, right, who wrote College Choice in America in 1983, explained to us that essentially, in his view as an economist, college was the great experiment. College was where you went to find out what you were really made of. Did you really have it? And if you learned that you really weren't cut out for college, no harm, no foul, you'd learn that about yourself and you left. No big deal. Well, I think that people were probably pretty disappointed when they learned those things, and maybe were not happy about the time they'd taken out of the labor force, right? Where their colleagues and friends from high school had been getting ahead while they had been spending time on college courses that they didn't do very well in. But at least they weren't getting the parting gift, so to speak, that today's students are getting. And that is student debt, okay? So the consequences of leaving college today without a credential are far higher than they've ever been before. And I want to underline this because a lot of times when we talk about student debt, we talk about it as separated from the completion issue. They are very much married to one another, which is to say the students who most struggle with student debt in this country are the people who did not finish college. They do not have six figures of debt. They didn't stay long enough to get it, but they do not have anything that will help them to repay that debt. It's a bit of a puzzle, given the numbers I just showed you, how it's possible that we would be spending $200 billion a year on financial aid and get these outcomes. Okay, now we can argue over how much in the federal budget ought to go to education. And you probably see me agree with you that it should be more. Okay, and we can probably agree that there are areas of spending that are perhaps wasteful in the federal budget that could be moved over to increase this number. But I will disagree with anybody who says that that's not a lot of money. And the fact is that we've got to ask ourselves, if we're making a $200 billion a year investment and students are still dropping out of college, especially students from low-income families, what is going on with this aid system? There are those who will say and have said very loudly in many places, what that tells us is that money really isn't the issue. They will tell us that the focus ought to be on the quality of our K-12 education. They will tell us that the issue ought to be helping people assimilate to college culture, right? Helping them to feel like they will fit in, be accepted. They will tell us that we need to do more to incentivize students to work harder in college, because what's really going on with today's students is that they're lazy. There's another set of folks who will say, well, it might be about money or about aid, but we're doing harm by having the government intercede. So there are those who will argue the reason that people are left without the money they need is that the price of college today is so high because the government subsidizes it, right? The idea being that if we only pulled back on federal student loans and didn't make them available anymore, the price of college would fall, because they believe that today's colleges and universities are largely wasting the money and are raising the prices so that they can absorb more financial aid. That's another argument, okay? I find all of these arguments fascinating, and I really wanted to know, is it possible that the takeaway of this juxtaposed with the numbers I just showed you is the answer is it's really not about money, it's about something else, okay? And is it possible that instead, it's actually a problem with the financial aid system itself and not about the students and their need or lack thereof for money? I set out to craft a study fueled by this, that there are students and families all over the country who are very, very clear that the system itself is broken, right? Polling data all over the place shows that people don't like the system. How many of you have done the FAFSA? Small American Bureaucratic Tragedy. People hate it. They hate it. Everybody hates it. And they're very clear about how much they hate it, right? So if they hate that thing so much, and so many students are saying, I'm short of money for college, might there not be some truth to this? So what we did was we set up a study that included the sort of now classic in education approach to figuring out what's going on, in which we, for the very first time, managed to distribute more financial aid to some people and not to other people. We took a group of all kinds of people who really all needed money, right, and a private funder, and gave out some additional money to some and not to others so that we could compare those outcomes. But I think far more importantly, we set up a longitudinal study with a very close look at these students and their lives and the lives of their families. And I think that one of the most important things about doing work like that is you become open to what you didn't know in the first place, right? When you sit close with people over time, rather than a cross-sectional one-time look, you can begin to see their decisions unfold. And so I'm extraordinarily grateful to 3,000 Pell recipients around Wisconsin who didn't just let us sign them up for a one-time study, fill out one survey, or do one interview, but let us collect their records, their academic and financial records over 6 years, submitted themselves to multiple surveys every fall for 3 of those 6 years, and 50 of whom sat down with us approximately every 6 months for 6 years, whether or not they were in college. This study took about $3 million and a staff, as I note in the back of the book, of a total of 200 people over 6 years to get this work done. I want to point out that we didn't just pick up the same old surveys that the federal government has been doing. The college surveys that the federal government does reflect the assumptions that American policymakers have about college students. These surveys focus on things like social cohesion activities, rather than assessing whether students' basic needs are secured. So we took a very different look and said, we want in the surveys to try to capture and measure the experiences of people that differentiate them, especially across social class backgrounds, but that they're telling us really matter in their lives. So if people are saying money matters, well, we want to know what you really do bring in for money from all sources and where money goes out to all sources. We want to know where your obligations are, right? Even when you can't give money, you may have the obligation to give money. We wanted to know more about their health and their well-being, something that we often do not check in on among our students to our great detriment. But we got 75% response rates year after year after year because, number one, the students said, nobody's ever asked us that. Thanks for asking. And by the way, thanks for the $25 you paid us to do the survey. Okay, so money talks. All right, so a couple of lessons that we learned from these students. First and foremost, there's what I'm gonna call a new economics of college. I think the old economics was, look, you go, your family has some money, the government sort of meets you where you are, the states put up a decent chunk of the payment, you put up some, you get some financial aid to cover the rest, and hey, you get a part-time job, and that then things work out. This is what the new thing looks like, right? Number one, yes, college prices are higher than ever, and that's true regardless of sector. So these students were all in the public sector, and I will defend that decision to my grave, because we are talking way too much about private colleges in this country, right? And frankly, we need to shut up about Harvard. Because Harvard educates enough low-income students, we could fit them all right here on this stage, the entire population right now, right? And yet garners headlines in the New York Times for doing so. Whereas 75% of American college students are enrolled in the public sector, and the prices have gone up entirely as a function of state disinvestment. Okay? This has happened at a time when most family incomes outside the top 10% are stagnant or even declining. And if you read the new book, The Financial Diaries, the other thing that we can characterize American family incomes is that they are volatile. Right? That there is a tremendous amount of turbulence now in the lives of American families. And third, that these students are going to college at a time when those public institutions lack resources to serve them. So we have to put that both means they don't have a lot of institutional financial aid with which to buffer these students. It also means that if you have a student in front of you with serious economic constraints, and you too have serious economic constraints, think about the changes to the teaching workforce, you are going to be less equipped, even with the less bandwidth, to be able to help them. All right, so let's go back and look at that Pell Grant. The Pell Grant is the centerpiece of the entire financial aid system, and it was created by Claiborne Pell in 1965 with the express intention of eliminating the relationship between family income and college attainment. So what it was supposed to do, just to be clear, was fully cover the cost of attending college for anybody who qualified. All right, now we can talk all about those qualifications. I think they're full of nonsense. They cut out a huge group of people who are frankly too rich, so to speak, to get the Pell Grant, but too poor to be able to afford college. But among those people who've gotten in, here are the trends that we've seen. So the first thing to look at is the number of people who've been qualifying for the Pell Grant just since the mid-90s. What we see is big increases in the number of people getting the Pell Grant. So if you thought to yourself, well, I went to college in the 90s, and yeah, there were some low-income people there, well, yeah, there were, but there were about, you know, less than 4 million Pell recipients in the entire nation. Okay, today, we're looking at almost 50% of students getting the Pell Grant, and there are, you know, approaching 10 million students, right, who have the Pell Grant in this country. Then we look at total Pell expenditures, the money the federal government is spending, and we see that the blue line tracks the orange line. Okay, it's supposed to. It's because this is what we call an entitlement program in social policy. And the entitlement program means if you qualify, you are entitled to get this money. The government is not allowed to say what most states say with their programs, which is, it's really nice that you qualified for it, but we don't have enough money for everybody. Okay? It's also the same thing we do in housing in this country, right? Lots of people qualify for subsidized housing, and they're placed on a waiting list because we don't have enough. Okay? So those lines are supposed to track each other, but policymakers forget that. And so when those lines went up and up and up during the recession, which is exactly when they were supposed to, right? It's when the economy goes down, more people qualify for the Pell Grant, and by the way, more people go to community college because the economy is lousy. They have time now to do that, and they need to do that to get retrained for other jobs. Policymakers in Washington started to ask all sorts of questions. Why does this thing cost so much money, they said. All of a sudden, it costs a lot. And, by the way, why are so many of these people on this program dropping out of college? So this is when the headlines started popping up about the lazy Pell Grant recipient. It is also the moment when we started to hear about a new participant in American life, a person called the Pell Runner. Is everybody familiar with the welfare queen? Got it. The Pell Runner is the modern welfare queen. Okay, the Pell Runner is the person that American policymakers believes has found a way to exploit the system by filling out the FAFSA, filing all that information with the college, getting into the college, getting the Pell Grant, and then running away with it. Maximum benefit, $5,500. Typical benefit, much lower than that. Right? And they think that people are doing this in droves, and this is why the numbers went up. Okay, so this is the logic. Now, what's amazing to me is that while we saw this heat grow and this backlash happen, and I started to get phone calls, people knew I knew Pell recipients. They thought I could introduce them to a Pell runner. I was like out there like Kathy Eden was looking for that welfare queen who we could not find, right? I really have not yet met anybody who thinks, oh, that's an easy way to make money, right? During this entire time, look what's actually happening to the benefit for students. See how those lines are flat? Those lines represent the average and maximum amount of that benefit. Problem with those flat lines is that that's not what college prices were doing during that time. Those lines go up the way those other lines go up, and they go up at even a faster pace. This is what happened to the value of the Pell Grant. We could call it purchasing power. When I was coming up in grad school, I was always shown a chart that looked like this, and they said, well, the purchasing power of the Pell Grant has declined, and then they would move on to the next thing. The human reality of these lines basically means that you're told, go to college, Pell recipient, we will make it affordable. The main mechanism for doing that is the Pell, and this is how much of college it will cover. It was supposed to cover 100%. We can see the public two-year and public four-year up there. It approached it at the public four-year like this one, but never really did it. And you can see how rapidly it's declined over time, to the point that even if you go to a public university, you don't even have 40% of your cost of attendance covered by the Pell Grant. You don't even have anywhere close to 100%, even if you're just in a community college. I don't even need to draw the private school lines up here. People find this out not in high school when they're thinking about how to pay for college, but after they've enrolled in college, shown up for their classes, enjoyed school, and then realized, oh, the Pell Grant basically covers my tuition if I'm lucky, and tuition is less than 50% of the cost of attending college. All right, so go to real numbers here. Like I said, we went real deep with these folks because if they said money mattered, we really wanted to know what money do you have and where's it going. So Chloe's mother, post-divorce, okay, she did convince the government not to consider her ex-husband's income since he went off to Florida with his new girlfriend. And so she made $25,000, a little more than $25,000 in the year prior to when Chloe went to college, which meant, and she did have a little bit in the way of savings, she also had a whole lot of debt that she owed to the lawyer from the bills following that divorce, but that's not reported on the FAFSA. We don't care about your debt when we're figuring out what you can afford to pay for college. So the expected family contribution that was supposed to flow, according to the federal government, from Chloe's mother to Chloe into the coffers of the college was $2,520, approximately 10% of her mother's prior take-home pay. Not discretionary income, right? But total income for the prior year. The community college that Chloe and I met at, where she was enrolled, charged annually over $15,000 a year. Now you might be thinking to yourself, well, that's just crazy. That must be the only college in the country, community college, that's got those prices. You'd be wrong. You're thinking about tuition. The total cost of attending college, according to federal definition, is fairly well aligned with actual reality, which is that to be in college, you have to cover tuition fees, books, supplies, medical costs, transportation, and those two things that we all require in order to be in school, housing and food, okay? And even when governors like Scott Walker, who became governor while Chloe was in college, even when he freezes tuition to make college affordable, the cost of living is still rising. So what governors tend to do is they freeze tuition, they do not increase financial aid because they think they took care of things. But of course, the cost of her rent was still going up, the cost of food was rising. And so if the Pell program were working properly, given how low income she was, she should have qualified for grant aid in the tune of $15,512 minus $2,520, but she got just under $3,000. And of course, like so many families, Chloe's mom could not afford to pay that expected family contribution. So that meant that that was actually on Chloe as well. So she was facing $15,512 minus $2,958 for a single year of community college. Chloe was afraid to take out student loans. I think very reasonably so, considering that her mom was sitting in a pile of debt owed to the lawyers and credit card debt and talked about it all the time. So Chloe was eligible for some student loans. You might think enough to cover things. Well, actually, the only thing Chloe could take were federal student loans. That's what she qualified for. And the maximum for a single year of college is $5,500. So even if she'd taken them, in other words, she would have faced a substantial shortfall. The only other option that we offer her is what's called a Parent Plus loan, which means that her mom would be expected to cover that, and it was based on her mom's credit. As you might imagine, her mother, like Ian's mother and Nima's mother, did not qualify. So what did Chloe do? She sold her horse. That was the first move she made. And what we're watching is students who are being castigated for not being hardworking, making sacrifices, including selling the thing that they love the most that drove them to go to college in the first place. The thing is, if you think a horse is very valuable, which she thought it was, you'd be wrong. Horse like Chloe's fetched her $1,200. She's still far short. The next thing that Chloe realized, as they all did, was that all the numbers I just told you are effectively lies. Those are all the official prices, and what do we know about official statistics and prices? They are nonsense. And when they are in the college area, they are nonsense for so many reasons. I can give you just a few now, but I've got a whole paper called The Real Price of College that will unpack them for you. You got this issue of families not being able to pay what's expected. But even bigger than that is the fact that this is one of the only cash transfer programs in the entire world that doesn't expect people, and especially children from low-income backgrounds, to use resources to support their families. There is a unidirectional focus in this program, parent to child. No matter, by the way, that the majority of today's college students are well beyond the point of parental support, even according to their age. No matter that one in four of today's undergraduates has a child of their own, and that 13% of today's undergraduates are single parents. Students like Ian Williams, whose mom helped him get to college, was regularly taking their student loan dollars and sending them to pay their mother's bills. Sometimes it's a check home, sometimes it's just walking it across the dining room to mom and saying, here you go. So when you fill out the FAFSA, if the year prior to college you were working and contributing to your family's income such that the child's wages are part of the family's total income for that year, and we run the numbers through the federal needs analysis, it will result in a negative expected family contribution. That negative means in order for the student to be made whole, we actually have to replace that lost income for the family. There is an actual number. It says negative, say $3,000. But the federal government says we don't pay families to help their children go to college, and chops off the negative and truncates it at zero. This leads to very difficult conversations, like the one that Ian had when he went to his financial aid officer and said, I see that you said this was my budget for college. I mean, they're so presumptuous, they will actually make a budget for a student and tell them that's your budget. Okay. He says, the amount of aid you awarded me is insufficient to meet my needs. She said, well, then you need to learn to live within your means, and referred him to a financial literacy program. What's really going on? Ian really does understand how to make ends meet, and he's helping his family do it. What a young person, or any person, frankly, goes through when they are confronted with a system that does not acknowledge how their family and so many other families, especially in their social class, work on a regular basis, they don't know what to do. He regularly was going through emotional turmoil because he felt very proud of his ability to do this for his mother and his younger siblings. His interviews are filled with stories about his younger brothers and sisters and how he would worry about them while he was in class and they were on the street. Being able to do something for them while he was doing something like go to college helped him to feel less selfish. So it felt good. On the other hand, he also realized he was sort of doing something wrong by giving away the resources that he actually needed, not only to start college, but to finish that degree. And as we help more students to realize that they need every penny they can get in order to actually finish their degree, we're pushing back on the part that actually makes them feel good.
You have been listening to Paying the Price on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to Sarah Goldrick Rabb detail her research into why so many students are forced to drop out of college and leave with debt. She was the keynote speaker for the Working Class Studies Association conference, which took place in early June at Indiana University. We now return to the show with Sarah Goldrick Rabb's research into the role of basic needs, like food and housing, in a student's college experience.
Okay, housing and food is absolutely critical. I'm confident that if you didn't eat this morning, you know it. I'm confident that if you do not have a regular place to sleep at night, you are probably not as well rested as those who do. And if you've ever tried to do anything difficult cognitively, write a paper, read a difficult article, do a math problem, it is hard to do that if you have not first secured your food and your housing. So food and housing are two of the most important things we can do to help students stay in college. But they are two variables in the college's calculation of their price that are the most mysterious. Now, we spend a lot of time talking and thinking about fancy dorms. Here's the problem. Only 13% of undergraduates today live on a college campus. 87% of people are living somewhere else. The only price that a college controls for food or housing is of the people who live on their campus. Yet, they are tasked by the federal government with listing the price of housing during college. They list it in three categories. Number one, on campus, two, off campus, without family, and three, off campus, with family. Category two is the majority of today's students. How does this university know what it costs to live in Bloomington? Okay, well, it's kind of a small area. So maybe they can figure this out. Maybe they actually know all the landlords and they know what's being charged, et cetera, et cetera. Either way, they gotta make a whole heaping set of assumptions about who's gonna live with who, what the organization's gonna be, of how these things will work, and what students are able to get in terms of prices for safe, secure housing. What they typically do is they survey their students and they ask them what they're paying. Think about that. If we ask what you're paying for food, and you've cut back on food so substantially that many of you are food insecure, those surveys are going to come back with low numbers that are actually not appropriate. Okay? Also, our financial aid offices are totally strapped for time. They have been placed under about 4,000 rules and regulations now by the U.S. Department of Education. They don't have time to do good research on these things. Instead, they list these numbers. Those numbers contribute to that total cost of attendance that the institution has to report that is reported everywhere, from U.S. News and World Report to iPads to all these sorts of other places. So they face pressure to lower that number as the heat goes up on college affordability. For-profit institutions all over the country are saying that they are ratcheting down their prices. They are not. They are ratcheting down their estimates of what it costs for their students to live in the United States. Okay? So these numbers are all kinds of wrong. There's one other kind that you'll probably be very interested in, given what you know about how working class families do things. Working class students are disproportionately likely to live with their families while they're in college. But they are also likely to contribute to the family's bills in college. However, colleges and universities are not required to report to the federal government what they actually list for those students who live at home. So you might see, for those students, they tell them that their cost of attending college for a year is usually about $8,000 to $10,000 less expensive than it would be for another student. Now, number one, that's bad information. Number two, it's even worse, because what they say that student's budget is, right? So if Debbie said on her FAFSA, I'm gonna live at home during college, they use that budget to calculate her aid package, and her maximum amount of aid she can get is her budget. So if they systematically understated her by $10,000, even if she was the most talented student getting all sorts of grants, she couldn't because she said she lived at home. Because they are allowed to assume that is how her family works. And of course there's this. There's a big push all over the country to say to students, pick the right college and aim high, right? Now this is rightfully coming out of a discussion in some, especially urban areas, where people have been worried that students of color in particular have been ignored by college counselors and have been shuttled to the nearby community college rather than apparently to like Harvard where they could have gotten in. That's how I'm gonna characterize the undermatch discussion. Undermatch is based on the idea that your match should be driven based on your test scores. You should go to the college for which you are most qualified for, and if you're qualified for an elite school, why would we find you at a local public institution? Number one, I actually think this is part of an attack on public institutions and a way to under-resource them further. Number two, it completely eliminates any discussion of economic challenges that a student or their family might be facing by assuming that if only you go to a more elite school, they will give you enough money to survive. Okay, so let me go ahead and just pick on one of them. So the New York Times has been proclaiming Amherst College as one of the best colleges in the United States. So Amherst College is led by somebody who proclaims herself a working class president as well. Somebody I know very, very, very well, who used to be the chancellor at UW-Madison. So I was recently invited to Amherst College, and so I spent a bunch of time. Again, I was invited by the students, not the faculty or the administration. Spent a bunch of time getting ready for that and looking at how they've been doing over the last several years, because the New York Times has been praising them and because the Jack Ken Cook Foundation recently awarded Amherst a $1 million prize for its great services to low-income students. First and foremost, because Amherst says that it meets full need of Amherst students. So if you get into the school, which is the number one hurdle, let's be very clear, right? It's a tiny school, let alone it is also very selective. Right? So if you can do those 2,700 things you have to do to get in, and you're from a low-income family or even a modest, frankly, middle-class family, they say you meet full need. I think our first assumption would be, if you're low-income and go to Amherst, student debt's not an issue, right? Because they just said they met full need. That would be one. And two is, it's not one of the places where you'd think that we would be having any conversations about things like food or housing insecurity, because it's Amherst College. They have a $2.3 billion endowment. With the small number of Pell recipients that they enroll, now admittedly that is a large percentage of the college, but it is still a small number of people, they have more than $5 million in resources per Pell recipient. Okay, do you know how much an average public college has per Pell recipient? $12,000. Okay, so I go into Amherst College, and they've lined up all sorts of administrators for me to get to meet and talk with, and I ask my favorite way of assessing whether low-income students are actually okay at a college. How many of your Pell Grant recipients graduate with debt? 28%. 28% of students in one of the wealthiest schools in the land are graduating with debt despite coming from the lowest income families. Why is that? I said, why do they have debt? The financial aid officer replied, well, that's their choice. Okay, what don't they cover? Well, they don't cover going home for these students when they need to go home at breaks. They don't cover when their parents need to come to graduation and can't afford to. Okay, all the things that other students do as a matter of course, just to fit in, they don't cover. They do some things, like students can go to activities. Certain activities are therefore made free for them. This is also true at Stanford. But students taking on loans so that their parents can come to graduation and then trying to repay those loans over time while also supporting their families, that's happening. Not only that, I only spent 24 hours on campus. In 24 hours, I met 4 homeless students. Okay? And I got names and numbers of countless others who were homeless while at Amherst. None of these folks want to speak out. None of these folks want to say a word because it is such a small place and because publicly everybody has been told it is so inexpensive to be there, this could only be a personal trouble. So the students who we work so hard with to fill out the FAFSA for their first year of college, they actually need to fill it out every single year, but we don't pay attention to them after the first year. So you've got plenty of students who will show up in the second year of college and say, man, my financial aid package is a lot smaller than it was last year. Yeah, because you didn't file the form. Or, even worse, well, you did file the form, but when you filed last year, the state had enough money to actually give you a grant to help offset the price of college, and this year we ran out, so it's not there. Or here's another one. Well, you got the Pell Grant last year, but this year you signed up for, say, 12 credits, and then your work schedule got in the way, and so you got a D in one class, and you dropped a second class. Guess what? Now you failed to meet the satisfactory academic progress standards of all federal aid. You've lost all of your aid, even though you're still sitting here for the second year of college. It's estimated that as many as 50% of all community college students are losing that Pell Grant between years 1 and 2. And in this free college movement, which is supposed to be about making college free and not academic requirements, they are putting in the same academic requirements. They could be doing a great thing, which is to say, when the student loses regular financial aid, we will actually catch them, right, with our program that does not have those requirements and keep them in. That would be a generous thing to do. That's not, in fact, what's happening. So underlying all of this is how people actually feel at the end of the day. And there are not a lot of nice words to describe how they feel. People have said to me, oh, it's because you're a sociologist that you put a dramatic word like betrayal in the title of your book. No, I'm using the word betrayal because students talk about being betrayed all the time. The other thing is these programs are so slow to deliver. So I told you about Chloe and how she didn't want to take loans. So after she sold the horse, what she decided to do was work her way through college. I mean, let's face it, like this is what you do. But she quickly discovered that working your way through college doesn't work like it used to, and she had to return to those non-decent jobs, right, that she had had in high school and collect 2 of them just in order to add up to 30 hours a week of employment, which is what she needed to pay her bills. She also decided that she would take 18 credits a term in order to get through faster. Now, we're in Indiana. Indiana would like to pat her on the back and say, good job. Because Indiana's very upset that students are taking 12 credits a term, which is the minimum for financial aid, rather than 15 or 18, because they think students just don't know they should go faster. So Indiana is actually the first state in the country to start tying financial aid to the number of credits that you take, trying to push students to go faster. What they miss is that students like Chloe can't handle 18 credits a term, and they will end up dropping. And when they drop, it is not inconsequential. Not only is the money that they paid lost, but they will mess up their satisfactory academic progress requirements. So that's what happened to Chloe, okay? Dropping those credits actually hurt her with her own financial aid while still not making ends meet. And in the process of trying to drop some of the work hours, she decided she would apply for a student loan. So she applied in October. She said, yes, okay, never mind. This is not working out for me. Let me have that student loan. It came at the end of December. This young woman received the check for her first semester student loan and her second semester student loan on the same day, deposited them, the next day got the letter from college letting her know that she'd been placed on academic probation for her financial aid because she dropped those classes. As a first-generation college student, didn't know what that meant and thought it meant that she was out of college. So she left. She got on the next plane to Florida to go live with her father, where she became a waitress for the next year while trying to repay that student loan payment of the $5,500. Okay, so this is how they make ends meet. She was not alone. This number of 25% of those two-year students, that's the 25% that took a loan even in their very first year of community college, something that was never supposed to be necessary. Here we've got 77% of these Pell recipients taking a loan for their very first year of college. Nationwide, at public institutions, 50% of all undergraduates now are taking student loans. But focus on those Pell recipients for a moment and remember that according to the Pell Grant program, no Pell recipient was to ever take a student loan because we were supposed to cover 100% of the cost of attendance. Today, among the Pell recipients lucky enough to actually graduate from college, which is less than half of them, 90% of them have student debt. Did anybody have a work study job? Okay, these are great. This program has very high satisfaction. In fact, it's 98%. You hardly ever find that with a government program. Problem is that this program is deeply underfunded and badly allocated. So you might think, well, work study should go to the students with the most need. It's a campus-based aid program, which means that it's allocated according to your campus, your college. And you would think, therefore, that places that educated more working-class folks would get more work study money. But you'd be wrong. The formula, which has not been revised since 1983, does not prioritize student need for work study. It is based on age of the institution. And so it flows towards Plymouth Rock. That is why only 1 in 10 Pell recipients in the public sector in the United States gets any work study job. 40% of today's undergraduates work full time. They don't work at one job though. Work doesn't work like it used to. If you need 40 hours of employment, then you're probably gonna need 2, if not 3 jobs. Okay? Those jobs are gonna have fun terms like, we don't know when your shift will be. We'll let you know 24 hours in advance. It's really hard to go to class as scheduled or to even let your faculty member know 24 hours in advance, right? If you have not been told by your employer. It is not the case that if a student does not have a job, they are not trying to find a job. The problem with job search, as we all know, is it does not pay. And it is incredibly dispiriting. It is demoralizing. It is time-consuming. And yet lots of our students are going through that. We have employers who say they need more people with degrees, but not employers who are helping students to get those degrees. So imagine in one of my first classes when the student across the room, the young woman, looks at me, she smiles, she takes a few notes, and then within about 5 minutes, she's down on the desk. Okay, we have all seen the students sleep in class. The question is, why are they sleeping and what are we gonna do about it? Right, so my initial response was what I think a lot of us do. I was dismayed. I thought, am I boring you? What's going on? So I let it go. And it was only the third time that she fell asleep in one of my classes that I decided to call her in to my office. Told her, come see me in office hours. She looked completely petrified. She came in, she sat down across from me. I looked at her, I said, what is going on? Why are you sleeping in my class? And she calmly explained before bursting into tears that she got off work an hour before my class started in the morning. Okay? She worked the graveyard shift. That was the job she could find. Those were the hours that paid the best. Stocking shelves at the local grocery store was how she afforded to be in my class. It drove home the lesson that we in social science tell ourselves, but we don't really live by when we're teachers, which is that we don't know what we don't ask about. The effective solution was the thing that I immediately grabbed for, which was give her a different job. And I created a work-study position. She got the work-study job, she finished college, she went on to graduate school in educational policy, and she is gainfully employed. We know what to do. We just don't do it. I have been studying food and housing insecurity, beginning with this study that I'm telling you about today, for many years now. And it is because when we went out to start doing these interviews, we very quickly learned that not only were students going without their textbooks or laptops, they were sometimes going without their food and or their housing being met. We used very standard USDA and HUD measures of food and housing insecurity. We got 33,000 students to answer a survey last fall at 70 community colleges in 24 states. First, two-thirds of the 33,000 students qualify as food insecure. Food insecurity runs on a continuum. Okay? This is everybody who's not at the highest level of security. I hope you all are at the highest level of security. It means that you eat every day adequate, nutritious food and secured in a socially acceptable manner. One-third of those are at the very lowest level of food security, which is the level associated with hunger. In addition, we found that about half of the students were housing insecure. Okay? The most severe conditions, and 14% of those 33,000 students who actually bothered to answer a survey met that condition. Okay, so is it an over or underestimate? In many ways, I don't care. Because even if this number is twice the real number, we're still talking about hundreds of thousands of people. And we are not addressing their needs. This is not a problem only in the most expensive areas. It is not only an East Coast or West Coast problem, which is where we tend to hear about it. We also showed that it is not related to the county's cost of living, nor is it related to how many Pell recipients you have on your campus. And this should be of great interest. We are finding sizable numbers of students who grew up middle class who are now homeless in college. Okay? Homelessness is not actually that well predicted by background characteristics. It is predicted by events. So it's not only the case that colleges and universities that enroll large numbers of low-income students are the ones who need to worry about this challenge. It's happening in places because the price is simply too high. And yet we find that despite this, they exert a ton of effort and great work responsibility, despite being homeless and in college. We find them to be almost as likely to be employed, to be more likely to be, nonetheless, even though they are employed, still hunting for work, but to be far less likely to be employed at a wage of at least $15 an hour. Very few of them get help. One of the reasons this is such a crisis is that while we talk about financial aid, we don't talk about the other things that actually do support people in this country when it comes to food and housing, and how those things do not get offered to students. So take the most popular one, free and reduced price lunch program. The day they graduate from high school, the program abruptly ends. Similarly, we offer housing, subsidized housing. Yes, we have waiting lists, okay? But would you know that in many cities, housing authorities have deemed college students not worthy of housing? They are so severe that, for example, we met a young woman who grew up in public housing in Milwaukee. She and her mom, she went to college, she enrolled full time, she's pursuing a bachelor's degree, and one day there's a knock on the door. And the guy says, you all have to move. Why? He said, because there's only one person living in your unit now. Well, there's two of us living there, me and my mom. You don't count anymore because you're a college student, full time. She said, are you kidding? I said, no. He said, you can switch to part time, then you'll count again. What does she do? She's not gonna put her mom out, right? So she switches to part time. After 11 semesters of college going part time, she drops out. It's very clear what happens when people are left in these conditions. And I am frankly most concerned with this psychological effect, which is a complete loss of hope. Let's talk about what we can do better. I think we're at a moment where there is appetite for doing better. I know it's hard to say that right at this moment, but there are things that we can do, and we have decided as a team to not be dissuaded. And we do not do these students any justice by minimizing in any way the role of money. Gosh darn it, it would be so much easier to do well in your remedial class if you could actually afford to be there. Okay? The biggest change over time is how many remedial education students are working full-time while trying to go to these classes and do not have their needs secured. We just ran a study, we don't have the results yet, where we attempted to manipulate the test scores, the placement test scores where people get put into remediation by doing this really innovative thing. We fed them because my K-12 colleagues know fully well that the way to raise test scores is to feed the children. And I want to show higher education we can do it too. Basic needs security, all the things I just described, this is the term that we're trying to get spread around the country. Rather than saying food and housing insecurity, make it really clear what that's really about. That's about the basic needs being established. We ask them so many questions when they start college. We make them fill out so many forms, and yet not one of those forms assesses whether students have these needs met. Maybe we're not gonna give them a house, maybe we're not gonna actually feed them, but we could at least flag them so that we know that they're in need of some additional support, so that we're conscious of those challenges that they're facing. Surprises are really bad. Emergency aid helps, okay? Emergency aid is a band-aid, but it is an important thing to do, and every single college campus should be working to have an emergency aid fund so that if a student is $200 short, they can actually come to somebody and ask for help. You're telling students that you get it, that this happens in real life, and that frankly, it's happened to all of us. We just had a family member to turn to, okay? We need to be able to provide that to our students. We have to fight to make work-study work. Now, Trump has threatened to cut the work-study program. I actually think there is bipartisan support for the work-study program, and I don't think the Pell program will actually get cut. It has more support than we have been admitting to. We need to fight to keep work-study. This is where things get really dicey. There are some ways in which college students are better employees than other folks, and we need to try to have a conversation about why that might be and where it would be advantageous to them to start employing a person who then they might be able to hire after they graduate. I am somebody who's spending a lot of time in the free college movement. I don't like what I see today, but Oregon got it basically right, and Tennessee did too. A lot of the challenges that I just described really will be resolved by free public higher education. First and foremost, because all money is free. If you can make it so they don't have to pay tuition, then they can use their work earnings to pay their living expenses, okay? A lot of people have said, well, you just showed us that there are hungry and homeless students in college, so if we only cover tuition, there will still be homelessness. Number one, I don't think so, actually. I think we'll see some great reduction because those monies can be used to fund living costs. Second, in K-12 education, we don't pay for living expenses, right? We made tuition free. And secondly, what came next was social support programs to address the living conditions of the people who most needed it. It is not perfect, but we got to admit that the number one reason people are dropping out of high school today is not a lack of money. We've largely eliminated that constraint as the main reason that they're leaving. And we would then be able to extend the National School Lunch Program, among other supports, to higher education once we began by declaring that the natural next step. I run the Wisconsin Hope Lab, and next year we're going to open the Hope Center for College Community and Justice, and this is what I want to leave you with. I know this is a very dark time. Students feel hopeless. It is very easy for the faculty, researchers, administrators around them to also feel hopeless. But we literally lose when that happens. And so in the face of hearing all of this from students, I really started to enforce this message that hope is actually the first step. There is a Harvard business professor who says hope is not a strategy, and so I say, yes, it is. Thank you all so much for your time.
You've been listening to Sarah Goldrick Rabb detail her research into why so many students are forced to drop out of college and leave with debt. She was the keynote speaker for the Working Class Studies Association conference, which took place in early June at Indiana University.
Been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.